You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Kat Rosenfield.
And I'm Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, and we are Feminine Chaos, extra chaotic this week, perhaps. So we have a whole lot to talk about with you today, and we're going to just jump right in with the... So this has been just maybe a strange week in terms of, we had a few sort of Me Too related topics and then the Kavanaugh hearing and madness happened. So we'll be talking about a few sort of all related topics. Also a little tiny bit about the Dreyfus affair. A once huge, but now somewhat obscure 19th century French debacle. So we're going to cover everything today. But I think what we're going to start with is this phenomenon, very 21st century phenomenon on Twitter, that I've been noticing in reference to Kavanaugh, but had seen before, where men on Twitter will tweet very proudly that they, unlike Kavanaugh being the implication in this case, did not rape anybody in high school or in college or in general. And there are variations of this phenomenon. There are women and others who will put retweet if you never, Kat, this was, I think, your phrasing, if you never did a rape or something, right? That was, because it was just too, okay, so there's that in which men are encouraged to do this. And then there's also the phenomenon of women tweeting that their sons, who are however old, you know, have never raped anyone, which they say with such tremendous confidence. And also the phenomenon of, I guess, fairly young teenage boys tweeting that they are horrified that people would say that teenage boys are all rapists, and they are, if you're 16, well, you have a lot of life to do good and perhaps bad things ahead of you. So what this is ostensibly about, just to kind of set this up, is it's pushing back against this, this sort of belief that we can discuss how many people actually share that all teenage boys rape girls, basically, or all heterosexual teenage boys are doing this. And this is, it seems to be a kind of, I would say, misguided way of saying that, which is true that not all teenage boys do this, but, the question, Kat, is this, is there any point to this?
Well, obviously there must be, and I think the thing is that what it accomplishes is not to actually establish any kind of truth in terms of, you know, vis-a-vis the behavior of the people saying, I never, you know, I never did or would do this. You know, some of, it feels like not infrequently, when somebody is accused of having, done this kind of bad behavior in their past, it will turn out that they had previously made statements suggesting that they were much too woke to ever do anything like that.
Oh yes.
Which, you know, which we'll get to in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But you know, what's sort of striking about it to me is that it's almost like a meme. It's like, you know, and it proliferates on Twitter in the same way that these participatory, you know, oh, what's your rap name? What's, you know, that kind of,
what's your social security number? And
yes.
Yes.
Yes. So you have these, you know, and it's this participatory thing. It's kind of tribal because, you know, you certainly see only a certain type of man doing this kind of performative retweeting of the RT, if you never did a rape.
Sorry, I can't take it. It's terrible. I mean, no, agreed that it's tribal, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it honestly reminds me, of like a bunch of, I don't know if this was a thing when you were in elementary school, but a bunch of little kids, you know, like putting their hand up on their head like this after somebody farted to be like, well, you know, I don't have to eat it. And they would all do this. I guess I went to like a weird public elementary school.
No, it reminded me of something from my elementary school as well, but something different where we were, I believe, 10 years old and had to sign some kind of contract that we were not going to smoke cigarettes for the entirety of fifth grade.
Ooh.
I know. And then we could, I think, have like a pizza party at the end or something if we didn't. And it reminds me of that, I mean, in a couple ways, one being who was fact-checking this.
Yeah.
Being, it was sort of absurd. And I remember there was exactly one girl in the class who was like the hardcore fifth grader who was like, I can't come to the pizza party because I smoked cigarettes. I mean, there's just something about the whole thing. I mean, it's such an upsetting topic. And then there's just this absurdity to the fact that here we are. Kavanaugh is saying that he did not commit an attempted rape. Nobody who's retweeting this believes him. The whole meme rests on this notion that he did, whereas these other men didn't, right? But then why are we believing these men online? Like, is there any even pretense that a man who retweets this is somehow more likely? So I would say there's three categories of men. I'm going to divide all of men, all of them, every last one on the planet, into three categories now.
This will work well.
Yes. So first, there's the men who just are not participating in these things, either because they're not as online or because they have the good sense to read these things but not share, you know. Then there are the men who are bragging about having done terrible things to women. And then there are the men who are doing these retweets. And I guess what I'm wondering is there any reason to believe a man who retweets that he would never assault somebody or didn't assault somebody is actually less likely to have done so than a man who's simply not participating in this meme?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we could suggest that the men doing the retweeting protest much too much, having not actually been accused of anything, like, why are you bringing this up? But actually, you know, when we were talking about what purpose does this serve, I think that it really ultimately has more to do with making fun of the person who is perceived to have done the thing. And in retweeting saying, well, I never did this in high school. It serves mostly to highlight the belief, either tribal or universal or somewhere in between, that the person being mocked through this exercise did do it and shouldn't be believed.
Yeah, I think that's probably right about the purpose. I wonder how it persists because it doesn't actually do that. And I guess what I wonder, I see just the sheer numbers of, and for the specifics, my Twitter feed is very much lately about this because I'm fascinated by this topic. So there are a bunch of concrete examples of this. The sheer numbers of retweets and likes these things get suggest, and you know, the favorable responses, replies they get, suggest that people are really taking this at face value and not looking at this. Hello. and are not looking at this as, let's say, as cynically as maybe we are, and are really thinking, good for these men. And I guess the most generous way to look at it is, yeah, it's good for men to model the behavior that it's not normal. It's certainly better than modeling the behavior that is normal to do these things, or that it's boys will be boys or whatever. But
keep going.
I'm used to there being a fluffy gray animal. I'm going to show mine just so she has a little cameo.
There we go.
So yeah, I'm used to the phenomenon of fluffy gray animals. But yeah, I think I just wish that this phenomenon would stop because it drives me up the wall for some reason. What really gets to me is I picture being a woman who was assaulted or just harassed, bothered in some way by one of these men, seeing him having retweeted something like this and how crummy that would probably feel, and how I just feel such certainty that that's out there.
You see that periodically in the replies on one of these.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when a guy does it, every so often a woman will pop up saying, excuse me, but what about that time that you did this to me or whatever? And it's usually something, I don't think it's ever been about something as serious as an assault, but it's been more like you mansplained to me, or, you know, you don't listen to the women in your life. Like, don't pretend that you're so much better. The another thing about this is that I think it is a form of pushback against the idea that this is a normal male behavior, which is, I don't know. I mean, obviously the whole boys will be boys thing is an attitude that is in the air, but I don't know if it really exists in the form that people are, you know, that people are imagining when they start trying to push back against it, the idea that everyone thinks it's normal for boys to, you know, to attempt to commit sexual assault. I don't think anybody actually believes that. And, you know, certainly nobody is raising their son to believe that it's normal to attempt to rape someone. And if you try to do it, no big deal. You've just joined a club with many, many people in it. I think that, but you end up with these, it's a complicated subject, and people try to talk about it in a way that gets at the nuances. It's like, no, most boys haven't attempted to commit rape, but particularly in the 1980s, before a sort of a different model for consent and relationships might have come about, it was considered like a normal version of a normal model for guys to see how far they could get and to see how far a girl would let them get. And in a world where women's sexuality was expected to be very passive, where they were expected to act as gatekeepers rather than pursuers themselves, you know, it would be easy to say like, okay, well, this is normal, and you wouldn't be wrong. Whether it's entirely healthy is another question.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think some people think this, and or whether or not they actually think it, who knows? But I think in light of, and this we'll talk about next up, is in light of the whole Kavanaugh story, I think there are people who hear a story like this particular one and will say, well, that's within the realm of normal things boys do. So I think that exists. I guess that my question is more whether it's ubiquitous enough to sort of push back against it as if that's the normal thing people think. And there I have my doubts. I think typically people do not see attempted rape as a normal thing boys do. I think it's a far too common thing that exists in the world, of course. But the notion that every single, I guess it, I almost wonder if what feeds into this.
There's a rapid exit. Keep going.
It's okay. I wonder if what feeds into this in part is, in fact, the sort of another Twitter meme of sort of like the whole sort of ban men, every man is guilty, all of this, making fun of the not all men, you know? Like, I think sometimes women just to vent, and this is brings up like the crazy ex-girlfriend song about this, about let's generalize about men. I don't know if you're,
I'm not a
familiar.
Don't watch that one.
It's, I'm pretty behind on it, but there's basically a song about how it's sort of making fun of, but also celebrating the sort of down with men bonding that women can do. I don't know. I think men should just, if they're not assaulting women, they should just keep at that. That's good. If I see a man tweet something like this, this does not make me think any more highly of him or make me think he's less. All it does is plants the idea that he's very preoccupied with this topic and very anxious about it, which is itself not great. It doesn't make me think a man has committed some crime. It just doesn't make me think he is less likely to have done so than I had thought prior to the retweet.
Right, right. I'm just trying to think if I come down in about the same place as you do. And I think I do. When I see this come across my timeline, I always roll my eyes at it. It's irritating. And I don't necessarily think that the men who do this performative retweeting are more or less likely to actually commit rape. But I do think that they are less capable critical thinkers, I guess, than somebody who didn't automatically retweet the dumb thing.
Well, I wonder though, I mean, is it about critical thinking or is there an element of sneakiness to it of like, I think it probably varies, man. By man, you know, I think some probably really feel earnestly that they're pushing back against boys will be boys and doing some kind of service.
It's true. We should give those men some.
Yeah, time. I think that's some of them. I think some of them, though, I mean, they must on some level know, some of them must on some level know that what they're saying could not be, isn't going to be fact-checked, basically, is the way to put it. Unless
it's meaningless. And it doesn't offer any insurance down the road, you know, against being accused of having done something like this either. It's not like you point to this tweet saying, but look, I've already said that I never did anything like this.
But, and this might be the transition to our next topic, you could point to a calendar from the 1980s what you were doing on a particular weekend.
Yes. Apparently. You know, that's that does make a good segue, and I'm going to just pull up my little timeline of events here as we segue into discussing what was at least the most dominant topic on all of my social media feeds this week, which was the Brett Kavanaugh scandal and hearings. And I'm going to sum this up as best as I can.
And I'm just going to interject that I had a very, very hectic Thursday and kind of fell behind on the news cycle starting near the end of Ford's testimony. I had to head out for the day and have not yet caught up as well as I would like. So Kat will be, consider me a visitor from another planet. That's what I would like. And Kat is going to explain what's happened.
I'm going to do my best. I don't think an actual visitor from another planet would be able to comprehend the insanity of what went on. So for the three people on Earth who didn't actually keep track of this story over the past couple of weeks, just about 2 weeks ago, right around the time that you and I last talked, this accusation emerged that Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee, was accused of sexually assaulting an acquaintance when he was in high school. And it first came to light in the form of Senator Feinstein saying that she was in possession of a letter. It was very Victorian, you know, I have a letter, indicating that there was this accusation out there. And from there, it all kind of started rolling downhill. More details about the story started to emerge. The press figured out who the accuser was, this woman, Christine Blasey Ford, and started trying to hunt her down. She ended up being outed. She had wanted to stay confidential. So she ended up speaking to the Washington Post. And as all of, as her story was starting to come out, other people started coming forward, to say that Kavanaugh had exposed himself. One woman said he had exposed his penis in college, to her, at a drunken party. And then another woman who was a client of Michael Avenatti's, which is a whole other can of worms, came forward to suggest that Kavanaugh was either a participant or maybe possibly a ringleader in organized gang rape parties in high school. So big mess. And it all culminated in a hearing this past Thursday, with Christine Blasey Ford flying in to testify before the Senate. Kavanaugh responded. It was difficult to watch. She was very emotional and very credible. He was furious and fighting back tears and belligerent. And I think the general consensus was that he did not handle his response well, although he may or may not have handled it in the manner that a person who believes he's been falsely accused would naturally. Mm-hmm. So that pretty much sums up the actual events, the hearing and the participants and, you know, and what everybody involved said and did. And it was a difficult spectacle. And then there was the reaction, which was another kind of spectacle. And it was hard to watch for different reasons, particularly online. I'm trying to think how to describe the kind of the reigning takes. There were a lot of very hot, very bad takes online in the aftermath of the hearings. In fact, conservatives seem to be being pretty quiet about it, and I'm not sure if that's because they correctly perceived that trying to poke holes in Ford's story was going to be a bad look, or if it's just that I don't really follow a lot of conservative voices, and that's not what I was seeing on my feed. On the other hand, left-wing folks on Twitter kind of en masse decided that they were all Perry Mason and all equipped with, you know, phenomenal lie detecting capabilities. And this was when things started to get incredibly stupid, as people like Kathy Griffin started weighing in saying, I'm a poker player and I can tell from Kavanaugh's body language that he's lying. Or, you know, in another vein, there were women saying, well, he reminds me of my angry, abusive ex-boyfriend, so therefore I'm sure that he did it.
Okay, so I'm going to defend partially the second, not the poker tells, but I can tell he did it because he reminds me of a particular person, in not that level of certainty, but I do think there's a value in sort of the patterns, if that makes sense, the pointing to that things like this do happen. Because I think things like this don't often, or at least until recently, didn't often get discussed. And what I think about a lot is, so I have been following the story, just kind of missing the very, very last crucial few days of it. But the Caitlin Flanagan article, this was in The Atlantic, right?
Yes, I actually didn't get around to reading that one before we got on the phone.
Oh. No worries, no worries. So I will do the ancient history of the Kavanaugh story, such as it is. So Caitlin Flanagan is a writer known for sort of contrarian feminist type takes. So whatever all the feminists are saying, she'll say sort of something that's not that. But she also has more recently written about fraternities and terrible things that happen at them. And what she wrote about, I don't know if it's most recently, but the thing I'm talking about was basically having had a situation similar, having been in a situation similar to the one that Ford describes having been in. And it was persuasive because it wasn't persuasive in an automatic, oh, well, in that case, sure. But I think the aggregate of stories like this from women who aren't necessarily the most sort of hyper woke feminist types, to put it mildly, who just say basically, yes, you know, things like this happen, something like this has happened to me. I think it's a crucial part of the story. I don't think it works as a hot take in the sense of like, Kavanaugh seems like a frat bro douche, therefore he did it. I don't think that's a meaningful take, even if it might be in my heart of hearts what I'm thinking some of the time. No, I mean, I think it's not valid. It's not really valid. But what is valid, though, is this sort of something like this, you know, can happen, basically, you know, like in the aggregate. That's where I would defend that type of take.
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, the fact that so many women came forward to say something like this happened to me, I think was a big part of why nobody suggested in the aftermath that Ford was lying, which I think it, there's a sort of a contrast here to something like the Anita Hill hearings, where, you know, a lot of doubt was thrown on her credibility. That didn't happen here, which is kind of nice, actually. I think it's correct to draw a line through that, saying, okay, like, on one hand, you know, women, a lot of women have had experiences like this, and let's, you know, acknowledge the power of that, as opposed to a woman having watched this hearing, seeing Kavanaugh get angry and taking to Twitter saying, he's angry, he reminds me of my angry ex-boyfriend, therefore he did it. You know, he seems like a, yeah. And I mean, to you know, give due credit to the other argument, which is that if you were on, you know, in front of a board of people, facing accusations of having done something heinous that you either didn't do or genuinely believe you didn't do, which is another facet of this that I want to touch on in a second, that you probably would be really angry and really emotional. You know, having been once accused of doing something that I did not do, that was something I wouldn't have done. You know, it made me really angry, and I could identify with that idea, you know, that you would be emotional, that you would be argumentative, that you may not handle yourself super well. Mm-hmm. But the other take on this, and it's a nuanced one, and which is, I guess, one of the reasons why I like it. But it feels correct to me in a way that sort of the villainizing of either side has not, is, it was argued persuasively by Katie Herzog in The Stranger that it's entirely possible for Ford to be telling the truth, about her experience as she perceived it, and for Kavanaugh to not remember it, because it wasn't a memorable event for him, because mm-hmm. he did not perceive himself at the time as attempting to rape somebody. It was just being drunk, messing around. You know, he doesn't recall it as a particularly interesting or traumatic or otherwise memorable moment in his life, which is a whole other kind of disturbing, you know, that a guy could do something like this in his youth to a girl and genuinely not remember it because it just wasn't that big of a deal to him.
Yeah. I mean, what I really liked about Katie's article was that she points out that's itself the problem, right? Like that if it was no big deal for him to have done that, that's not an excuse. That's its own thing. I guess what I wonder though is, so I've been trying to catch up, and from what it seems like from his testimony, it seems as if he's adamant that this party never took place, and he's swearing he was hanging out with other people that night, which I guess
that's not quite,
was that not it?
No, I mean, he brought out his calendars, showing himself as being very busy throughout the summer, doing a lot of traveling, doing a lot of sports, to suggest that it was unlikely that he would have been at this party, you know, that he, as far as he's concerned, has never met Ford, has never been at a party with her.
Okay. And so that would be consistent then with that it just could have happened and not registered for him.
Right. And I mean, nobody else who's been identified as having been at the party, including Ford's friend, remembers it. Again, because it probably wasn't a memorable event for them the way it was for her.
How to put this? I guess, so I have a couple of thoughts about this whole thing, which is in terms of like the case itself, and then sort of like stepping back and sort of what to make of all of it. I guess what I find most credible about the story, and about Ford's testimony, is this notion that if you have some horrible experience in the past with a guy, and then it's decades later and you don't want to think about it, but then he's suddenly on the cusp of having humongous amounts of power, that you would then choose that moment to speak up seems so, like, I could imagine being in that situation very easily. And I could imagine, and even though it's a case where I did in fact speak up at the time, but it was a less aware time, so nothing came of it. I could totally see that. And that the fact that she hadn't all along been kind of talking about this, you know, writing personal essays about, you know what I mean? That did not, I feel like the fact that she had wanted to just kind of keep the whole thing quiet and not think about it, I found just rang true. That aspect really of it rang true, that she seemed to be very reluctantly coming forward, which it seemed, and it also, that combined with the fact that what she is accusing him of, if she were really there to just torpedo his prospects and it was really some sort of political thing, why wouldn't she just say rape? Why would she say this thing that is admittedly strange? You know, it's not strange, it's just not so definitive as if it would be rape. You know, it's terrible and it's definitely assault, but it's, why would she stop before actually saying that, you know? So that's where I think, just like these details, because I don't think it works to say automatically that, to believe all accusers automatically at all times. I think obviously everybody seems to be maybe slowly, I don't want to say everybody, but you have to listen to stories and whatever your bias is towards, you know, my bias would be towards believing, but you know, I listen critically in this. Yeah, that's sort of where I come down. But yeah, I don't know.
I would just say that your take is actually, I haven't seen anybody suggesting otherwise. I mean, I suppose maybe in cynical corners of Twitter that I don't frequent, where people have the inscrutable red X next to their name. They may be suggesting that she is a liar and an opportunist. But what I've seen mostly, and this includes amongst mainstream conservative voices, is that everybody believes her. Where the quibbling is coming in is you know, was it definitely him who did this to her? Or was it definitely, did he definitely perceive it the same way as she did?
Need to have perceived it the same way? I mean, I think whether it's him or not is, I mean, I'm not doubting this particularly, but that to me seems the relevant question, not whether he felt it was a big deal or not, because I think that's where I think, if he didn't see it as a big deal, and to this day doesn't see why this would have been a big deal, that's where the question of, like, I think what people can get kind of sidetracked on is, does having a blemish in your past, even a really bad one, mean you can't have a productive career? And the answer, ideally, is no, but that's not what this is about. This is about having a blemish in your past and how you then respond about it. And I guess if it's just to sort of deny it and to, you know, use your children kind of in the testimony as a shield, saying like that it made his children sad that he was accused, I don't know. I think it's more his response in a way almost but it's tricky. And then did you have more on this part of it?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's quite messy. And the big takeaway for me was not that I feel I definitely know what did or didn't happen. And I am mostly annoyed at people who seem to be claiming that they magically do know when I don't think anybody can know for sure, except for the people who were there. But the thing that struck me about this was less the details of the accusation and less Kavanaugh's reaction to it and Ford's reaction to it, but rather the way everybody else reacted and how badly it's been handled by literally everybody. It seems to have illuminated some real brokenness in our system, in the way that we talk to people on the other side of the political aisle. The tone of the discourse surrounding this has been so snarly. People just, I don't know. It's been depressing. It's been depressing to watch.
Mm-hmm. On the note of discourse, so something that seems to have come up a lot in the discourse about Kavanaugh is this question of privilege and his privilege and that he is privileged. And this, I think, is something that's on the one hand abundantly true and relevant in ways that it isn't in other cases where the concept of privilege gets invoked, but in other ways is sort of playing out in exactly the same unhelpful terms as it often can. So I think it is a relevant concept here, because I think somebody who truly has had every break imaginable in life, not simply, you know, a straight white man or something like this, but, you know, in terms of prep school and Yale and all of this, and given when this was all transpiring, probably really has had a very different experience of what he is allowed to do than somebody else. And even just in terms of talking about the testimony itself, a lot of people have been saying online that, like if they went to something like this and talked about how much they loved beer, they would be like, they wouldn't have a shot. They would be considered unemployable. And here's somebody who can keep sort of talking about beer and potentially be on the Supreme Court. So I see it, but then what I think hasn't quite added up, I think to talk about the privilege that Kavanaugh has as he's a straight cis white man. I mean, he is, but what his life has been is so different from what's typical of people who fit into that fairly enormous demographic. So I think that's a place to be wary, to describe that as kind of, you know, to conflate that with his specific situation. And I think also this notion that I've seen popping up a bit again of like the missing piece is privilege awareness, that Kavanaugh needs to understand that he's privileged, or that people need to understand that Kavanaugh is privileged, seems that never works. That never works. If the issue is that he did something terrible and is denying it, and if that's presumably what the opinion is of people making these arguments, is it really that he needs to be alerted to the fact that he can get away with things? Is that really what's missing? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So that's where I've seen the discourse be both helpful in some ways, because I think it is, I think privilege is relevant here, because I think in an ideal world, nobody does what he has allegedly done and denies it and gets away with it. It's not that I think in an ideal world, everybody gets an equal chance to do that. I think in an ideal world, nobody does. Whereas I think often privilege is used to talk about things that should be rights for all. So I think it is the right term, but I just think there's a danger in kind of using it to describe too much of humanity. And
I mean, what strikes me is that Kavanaugh's privilege is not, it's not white privilege, and it's not male privilege or being straight or being cisgender. It's literally that he is privileged. He was born into a wealthy family. He went to Yale. His grandfather went to Yale. You know, it's class privilege.
Well, it's all of them. I think it's all of them combined. So I think the way I see it, it's not that it's class rather than these other things. I think it's all of them together. And I think this is a problem that comes up a lot in specifically discussions of white privilege, but I suppose why not throw in cis and male and straight and such in there too. where the things that are given, that the people who are the more sort of woke side of things will confess to having whichever privilege, are things that, this is reminding me that we're going to talk about the BuzzFeed privilege article.
Yes.
That it's like not really about, it's all these things working in conjunction, but it's not on its own, any one of them. And that to say that basically having a certain life is how it goes for white people in America is, it ends up just alienating the millions of white people in America who do not relate to that. Yeah. Because that's not their lives.
I mean, I would push back on the idea that it's that, you know, we need to quantify this as white male straight cisgendered privilege when those are not the, I don't think they're the defining factors. I mean, it's not as though Kavanaugh's life is representative in any way of the average white straight male cisgendered person.
Well, no, certainly not. But I think that his gender and such do play into it in terms of, if you think about him versus his accuser, who is from a similarly privileged, similarly white, by all accounts, similarly straight and cisgender background, but is in a very different position in all of this. So I think it's not that I think, obviously class is huge here, and I think it's just all of the things in conjunction in one way or another, if that makes sense. I don't know.
I think maybe we just disagree, and that is okay.
We are allowed to disagree. We don't agree to disagree. I have to say the thing about the Dreyfus affair, because I promised this on Twitter. So I think people
yes.
have been talking about, so the Dreyfus affair, what it was, in the late 19th, early 20th century in France, a Jewish army officer, Alfred Dreyfus, was falsely accused of treason, of spying for Germany. This case was brought to the public's attention by Emile Zola, or Zola, if you prefer, the novelist and intellectual, who wrote famously this article, J'accuse, or I Accuse, taking Dreyfus's side, protesting for Dreyfus's innocence. This split French public opinion between kind of like the left and the right, basically, to sort of simplify. And to this day, whenever anything comes up, certainly not just in France, whenever anybody is either possibly falsely accused of something, and whenever public opinion splits, people start talking, and it's a way to sound very sort of learned to say, it's just like the Dreyfus affair. And people are like, what's the Dreyfus affair? Well, you see here. And actually, you could probably read some books about it. By just a fluke, this is the weird subtopic I became obsessed with in college and spent some of grad school researching, because I just found this really an interesting topic. But what I think people are saying about this, and this is just in terms of Me Too in general, and also there's a new movie by Roman Polanski, of all people, about the Dreyfus affair, which, according to a Guardian article, has caused furor on social media, but it didn't seem to have caused that much furor on social media. But in any case, the way it tends to get brought up these days is both in terms of the possibility of a man, possibly a Jewish man in some cases, although clearly not in this Kavanaugh case, being falsely accused of something Me Too-ish, or in terms of this notion of the split of public opinion. And I guess I would say that there's a third and perhaps most relevant way that the Dreyfus affair is relevant in all of these cases, which is that a sort of less discussed facet of it is that basically the anti-Dreyfus side, so the right-wing side that believe Dreyfus should stay in prison, and exiled in prison, it wasn't that they necessarily thought he was guilty. It wasn't that they didn't believe the increasingly very concrete proof of Dreyfus's innocence. It was that they thought it was more important to
the whole menagerie is here.
Oh, that's great. That they thought it was more important to like preserve the reputation of the army and of to keep France sort of, not really officially, but a Catholic country and all of this. So that there was something bigger than the truth that they wanted to preserve. So that's where I think Dreyfus fits into this. And that's the Dreyfus segue that all of you, every last one of you, has been sitting at home waiting for.
I was waiting for it. I had not heard of the Dreyfus affair, or I guess I'd heard it referenced in a sort of a lofty intellectual way that made me too nervous to ask what it was.
Well, it's a thing, you know, and it's yeah. credited or blamed for or whatever being the reason there's the state of Israel. So it's also controversial for that reason because of reasons that I am not going to digress into. But if you tweet at me asking to talk about the Dreyfus affair and Zionism, there's a non-zero chance I'll respond with interest, but I might be too busy.
Well, I did, I read a piece in the American Conservative, I guess it was, of all places, discussing the comparisons between the Kavanaugh situation and the Dreyfus affair. And what was interesting to me was that in this case, you have the political right perceiving themselves as the victims in this situation. Yes. And that is, it's one of those things that always makes me kind of go, like, seriously. But at the same time, there is a certain amount of, and it sort of ties back into the privilege question, where there's a sense that it's, whether accurate or not, there's a sense amongst a certain aggrieved portion of the population who's growing more resentful that it's become open season on, you know, straight old white men. And that when you have conservative writers making these comparisons, bark, bark, that they are perceiving themselves as, you know, the victims of persecution and, you know, in a way that, you know, in the same way that I guess Dreyfus was, you know, a victim of persecution in part because he was Jewish.
Well, yeah, and he was also, this is actually, oh boy, this could be such a sinkhole, so I'm going to try to make this brief. In looking back on it, especially looking back on it today with World War II, something we all know happened, you know what I mean? Looking back on it now, you think, okay, well, Dreyfus, French Jew in the 19th century, surely the oppressed party, surely people just got that. But that was not the case in late 19th century France. He was, in fact, from a well-to-do family. And initially, socialists were resistant to taking up his cause because they were saying, why are we going to take the cause of this privileged army officer, this bourgeois? So that it was really the Dreyfus affair that kind of took, not 100%, but kind of removed anti-Semitism from the French sort of socialist movement to some extent.
Interesting.
And my dog has a lot of thoughts
about the Dreyfus affair.
All of this. yes. So I think maybe we skip the BuzzFeed privilege article unless you have thoughts on BuzzFeed and privilege.
No, that was really, you know, that's your area.
Yeah, okay, so yes, I had read and been fascinated by an article in BuzzFeed about privilege, but it seems so last news cycle. So just accept that there is one and that it was weird. so then I guess just we'll maybe briefly at this point discuss the male feminists. So Kavanaugh, he claims to be a great ally of women, and I do think this is relevant to some of how things have played out, the fact that he has made all these points in his testimony and just generally that he is a real supporter of women, because I think then that sets him up for the charge of hypocrisy. But I think it's fair to say he's not part of the, like, woke male ally community online.
Right. I mean, I will say just about Kavanaugh that when he says that he's been a champion of women, he's pointing to actual accomplishments over the course of his life, having, you know, hired and promoted and supported right. women in a professional capacity.
And to the basketball coaching.
Right. Well. That too. But that puts him in an interesting contrast to men who spend a lot of time talking the talk, but don't necessarily walk the walk.
Right. I mean, I think Kavanaugh, what he's pointing to is it's not necessarily material in terms of what he did or didn't do in specifics, but it's certainly, he can point to things beyond the virtue signaling, basically, in that regard. Yes.
He didn't just retweet the retweet if you never did a rape tweet.
Oh boy. And if he, so there have been, a couple of cases recently and not so recently of male feminists who stand accused of things that fall quite short, in fact, often of what Kavanaugh stands accused of. But because they identify as male feminists and have this history of having perhaps virtue signaled or built entire careers of seeming virtuous online, relatively minor offenses get kind of, that, like, you can have an article, as there indeed was in Jezebel, pretty much based on the notion that a man who presents himself as a feminist, has been crappy to women on dates. Now, this particular story in Jezebel was a weird one, I think, because it wasn't just about being crappy on dates. There was also in the mix an allegation of non-consensual choking, which would certainly count as assault. But then also in the mix and treated as entirely relevant was basically that he was kind of not as into some women as they were into him. And it was very hard to, this was this Jack Smith the Fourth, is this correct?
Yes, the Fourth.
Mike the Fourth. Which, yeah. So I guess, so male feminists, should they be held to a higher standard than, male non-feminists, I guess.
Gosh, you know, maybe on an interpersonal level, you know, you meet a man who professes to be a feminist and you know, individually, one-to-one, may expect him to behave. Barky, barky. Hush. Hey. Winston, come here. Oh.
They're both lively today.
Yeah, well, there's a human being outside working on his car, and
I don't think that's allowed.
Perish the thought. Hey, buddy. Oh God. Well, hopefully people could still hear me or the sound of the barking dog. I can't think with this going on.
Okay, so it's my dog is now curled up and quiet for a change, so I'm going to try to, I'll ask maybe another question about it. So male feminists, yes, on an interpersonal level, they certainly shouldn't have the law different for, you know, I think being rude on a date should not, while professing online. I mean, I guess the only place I see where there could be any legal, any sort of legal ramifications of this is this question of somebody misrepresenting themselves. So if somebody is claiming, I mean, I guess that's where I feel like it all gets a little hazy, where it seems like there are claims that there's these men who present themselves online as very aware feminists to seduce women, basically, and that these women are then sleeping with these men under false pretenses. And the question is it equivalent to lying about medical status, marital status, something like this, to present yourself online and maybe on the first date as a very aware feminist when you are in fact just saying this to get into a woman's life? I guess to me this seems a dangerous road to go down, because I think people, is it really deceit on the same level? I don't know. That's where I think it's a little hazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, once you start down that road, who hasn't, you know, who hasn't presented a better version of themselves on a first date than the person they actually were? Even if it's not lying. And, you know, this is an interesting question, because were these men, you know, the man who claims to have a very woke feminist perspective, Is he actually lying about that, or does he just contain multitudes and despite having this perspective, he's still capable of treating women poorly on an individual basis?
Exactly, exactly. I think that's where some of these things can kind of fall apart, is this implication of intent. I think it's very hard to demonstrate that a man isn't simply flawed, trying to be the best feminist he can, but crummy in his personal life, and that it's actually genuinely a strategy to seduce women. I think that, I'm sure, like everything in this world, I'm sure it's out there, but I think it's a very hard thing to prove.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I will say that I was very frustrated by this, the Jezebel article, particularly for a number of reasons. The first one being that I don't think it's newsworthy. I think it's opening some really problematic doors to make a private citizen's dating life into a report, you know, to do a report on it and to do this kind of expose style thing where, you know, it's treated like it's a big thing that everybody should want to read. I've been thinking, and I mean, I feel like I know the answer to this question, but about what would happen if a men's website published a similar takedown of a prominent feminist woman online saying, well, you know, this is who she presents herself as on Twitter and in her writing, but here are five of her ex-boyfriends to talk about what a terrible person she is. I think that that would be like roundly denounced as rank misogyny, and that there would be a, you know, a good point to the denunciations.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think this question of newsworthiness is really key, because I think the piece that this sort of brings up, and that even in the Jezebel piece this is brought up, is the Aziz Ansari Babe.net piece about how he was pushy on a date. The comedian and performer, the actor Aziz Ansari.
Yeah.
This is somebody much more obscure who I'd certainly never heard of, and I've read my share of nonsense on the internet. I had never heard of this man before. I think that there, so I guess where I come away from this is thinking there is a value in being able to talk about, and this brings us sort of full circle to our first topic with this retweet, if you did not do a rape meme, but I think there's value in talking about the fact that people are not necessarily how they present themselves online, especially in light of the fact that while that may seem obvious as, to us as we're talking about it, a lot of people seem to miss that memo. So I think there is value in remembering this. The question is how that gets discussed. And I think it is a dangerous road to go down, that people who are not public figures have their personal lives looked at under a microscope. I think what was weird in this case was that there was in the mix of all this sort of nonsense a serious accusation, whether true or not, I don't know, but the point is it was a serious accusation, whereas so much of the text of this post was basically like, this guy was an asshole, which perhaps he was, but is that a news story?
Well, I mean, I think that what the Jezebel piece was attempting to do, and they you know, as much as said so explicitly in this incredibly lengthy preamble, you know, explaining why it wasn't inappropriate to be discussing this, was to take something like an accusation of non-consensual choking and then lump it in with all of these other accusations of essentially having been a liar or been rude or been overbearing. The idea that these more frivolous offenses would be taken more seriously and considered as part of the Me Too movement. You know, we need to talk about this stuff also, and we need to treat it as seriously as we do allegations of sexual assault and rape. And that instead what ends up happening is that the inclusion of all of these things together and the lumping in ends up, for I think most reasonable people, just calling into question the more serious of the offenses. It's like, well, why are you lumping this in with these other things? Can it possibly have been the worst version of this, as opposed to something where there was room for misunderstanding. Because if it was really so terrible on its own, why aren't you just writing about this?
Yeah, I think I'm going to make this all come completely full circle to our last blogging heads with the modern love writer saying that ghosting on somebody is kind of a violation of their consent.
Yes.
I think that this expanding, I think it is useful to talk about gray areas of all kinds and to talk about the fact that hurt doesn't just happen in these more extreme or illegal cases. I think that's valuable. But the way you do that is by maintaining an understanding of what gray is and not conflating the gray part with the extreme, you know. Not, I don't think it works to define ghosting as a violation of consent or dumping somebody as a violation of consent. And I don't think it works to define a guy presenting himself as very woke online, as a feminist ally, as deceit on the level that's a violation of consent either. I think, yeah, that's pretty much.
Yeah. And, you know, I, as always, want to say that I don't think that kind of conflation or this kind of narrative is good for women or good for feminism. One thing that struck me, and it was similar to something that struck me in the Modern Love column that we talked about last time, was the number of women who came forward in this piece to say, Jack Smith did X and it made me feel Y, so I then did Z. And that means that Z is not my fault, it's his fault. I don't think this like thorough abdication of agency is good for women. It's certainly not the kind of feminism that I grew up with.
Well,
and, I don't know. There's probably a much lengthier discussion here to be had, but I continue to question why it is that we are collectively so uncomfortable with the idea of women having agency and then using that agency to make bad, regrettable choices that they are ashamed of and then have to deal with, and why it's seemingly so much more desirable to say, no, you know, it's not your fault, this was done to you, you're a victim. I don't know why we're so much more comfortable with the idea of women as victims than women as full human beings who sometimes make really dumb choices and have to cope with that.
I don't have much to add to that. I think the only thing I could say is I think this notion of women as agents, as active, as pursuers and so forth, never quite made the headway some might imagine. So times maybe never quite changed as much as one might think. And this, yeah, that could be part of it. Who knows? Who knows?
It feels like a step backwards to me from, you know, even the way people were talking about this stuff 10 years ago. But
are we just old feminists? Old decrepit feminists?
A couple of old crones.
That might be it. Leading the old millennial. Who knows?
It's true.
So any other thoughts on any of this?
No. I think we've pretty much, when we have, as always, come around full circle somehow.
Yes. All right.
Did you want to recommend Toronto?
I want to recommend shopping in Toronto, but I don't know if I have a segue that's good. But people in Toronto always go on shopping trips to New York, and I just recommend doing the reverse trip, not just because of the exchange rate, but because we have good stores here.
Oh.
But then none of them unfortunately sponsor Feminine Chaos or anything, but if any of them want to, no. So that's really my recommendation. I especially like a Korean boutique on Queen Street, just west of Spadina, called Durumi. That's my recommendation. Go boutique shopping at Durumi and get nice made in Korea clothing.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yeah. Do you have any recommendations?
No, I wear yoga pants every single day.
Well, you can't see what I'm wearing. I mean, I am wearing yoga pants as well.
But, I was gonna say, yeah. I do teach yoga. So, you know, it makes some sense. I've got nothing. I picked up a chestnut on my walk this morning in case anybody wanted to see it. We'll do show and tell. There it is.
That's fantastic.
I recommend this chestnut. They're very satisfying to hold.
I'm completely convinced. All right, Kat.
Well, it's been fun. It's been chaotic.
It's been feminine chaos. All right. Till next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.